Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And welcome to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, your host, and we are so happy to have you here today with us on Music from the Tower because we have a very, very special guest. Now, this program has had some organists before, but this is an organist. This is not your mother's organist, let's just say. This is Dr. Stephen Ball. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
It is very wonderful to have you. We have had Fred Swan. We have had Paul Jacobs. We've had David Ball, the organist right here from Christ Cathedral. So many wonderful organists have joined us on this program. However, Stephen is an organist like none of the rest of us, because not only does he have a doctorate in organ from the University of Michigan, plays every classical piece known to man, but he's also a theater organist. He's also a carillonneur. He's also a silent film accompanist and composer. He does everything, and he just happens to be the organist at the world's largest organ. So, Stephen, what don't you do? You do everything.
Well, that's a wonderful way to describe what I feel my mission is, which is to change hearts and minds about what the incredible over 3,000-year history of the instrument has brought us. And at this time in our culture, the organ occupies a very different place than it did even just 100 years ago. And I think that part of changing people's perceptions of the instrument, which in our day and age can be even so confused as people aren't aware of the difference necessarily between an organ and a piano, because we have instruments, there are many digital instruments now which can try and sound like a whole bunch of.
Yeah. Or a pipe organ and an electronic organ.
Well, so I think the best way to explain the difference that I found for our audiences at the hall and when I travel and do concerts is it's sort of the difference between plastic flowers and real flowers.
Yes, it is indeed. Just yesterday I was asked on the radio what the difference is between a pipe organ and an electronic organ, and I tried to make some sense of it. But so you can tell today's program is not just about Stephen, although it's certainly going to circle around his incredible career, but it's about the organ itself. We talk a lot on this show, Music from the Tower, about the organ Hazel and our wonderful fifth largest organ in the world, which is returning. But now we're speaking to somebody who does play the largest organ in the world. But before we dive into the organ, let's talk a little bit about Stephen so you know the incredible person that you're speaking to. What brought you to music? When did you begin your musical life?
Well, the music came to me really before conscious memory. I've always been deeply interested in sound and in anything which relates the worlds of sound, art, and mechanics. And so the organ is very naturally a child of this intersection of ideas. I was first aware of the organ consciously in church. And so from a very young age, I was always fascinated by the sound of the instrument. And I still remember the very first pipe organ I played. I was 6 years old at the time. And my dad, who was both a farmer and a fireman, he was also a very good engineer. And so he checked several books about organ building out of the library and was an extremely resourceful man and saw my interest. And at that young age, he helped me build a very small little pipe organ in our basement. And that began this incredible love affair with this ancient art.
Well, that's what happens when you have a little genius child living in your home.
Oh, but also very supportive parents.
And incredibly supportive parents. So you went from a six-year-old precocious child playing the organ in your basement, and perhaps when did you begin playing in church? Was that your next step?
9 years old.
9 years old. Wow.
My first church job. Yes.
I don't even begin to think of what I was up to at 9 years old. Certainly not playing the organ in church or anywhere else. And then you went on into the high school years. What happened in there?
I was very fortunate at a certain point in my education. My mother decided the best step would be to homeschool. There are, as people will say, advantages and disadvantages to it. But for me, it was a tremendous advantage to be able to work at the speed that I needed to learn at. I tended to want to be very aggressive in my studies, and so I was able to move very quickly.
And did that give you more practice time?
Yes, that was actually part of the reason to have made that transition.
I've had two exceptional students, both of which went on to Eastman, who found themselves by mid-high school just needing to make that transition because they wanted to practice 3 or 4 hours a day on the organ and really hone their career, and they couldn't do that and school at the same time. But then you went on to the University of Michigan. When did you enter the university?
I entered the university in 1996, first as an undergraduate, and had a very interesting academic career because I did my undergraduate and graduate work at the same university. But in between whiles, I lived in France for a year. I did cultural studies and musical studies there. And then
That a result of a Fulbright scholar? Is that...
No, the Fulbright, I was notified about the Fulbright scholarship when I was living in France, because I had applied before I left, and the Fulbright scholarship was to the Netherlands.
Wow.
So I moved from France to the Netherlands.
To do Carillon study there? Was that what that Fulbright was about?
Yes, I was a student of Carillon and campanology. So campanology is the entire subject of bells, their history, how they're manufactured, their acoustical properties. And this interest had also come from a very young age. I've found myself fascinated with bells, as I was with organs. And both of them occur naturally in Catholic churches, so I loved church. And I should go back just a step and mention that one of the reasons I was homeschooled is my parents took great care in my religious education. And they felt that homeschooling was the best way to provide a very solid Catholic education in the environment that I grew up in rural Michigan.
An awful lot of our guests have found their way either to a more sophisticated spiritual life through music or a more sophisticated musical life through the church. You know, it's amazing the number of people who have come into our studio to talk about their beginnings in music, as we're doing right now with you, only to find out that it was really the church, not even necessarily the Catholic Church, but certainly the Catholic Church in many instances, has led them to their musical blossom. I'll never forget a wonderful speech by Cardinal Egan to a whole bunch of children saying he's a cardinal in the church because of his young age being involved in the choirs and music. And so that's pretty cool. So at 16, you were in Marilyn Mason's studio, the head of the organ department.
Yes, Marilyn was a tremendous influence in my career.
And about 5,000 other organists as well. She was at the University of Michigan. How many years?
She was the longest-serving faculty member there, well over 50 years. I think it was 56 years on faculty.
That's a lot of students, a lot of people coming through that studio, isn't it? So you went all the way through with a little stop for a Fulbright and a little stop in France,
mm-hmm.
through your doctoral studies at Michigan?
Yes, and then when I did finally graduate in 2007, they paid me the greatest compliment they could pay a student, which is they hired me. So I became at that point the university's carillonier. And the University of Michigan has, in addition to one of the oldest and most well-respected organ departments in the country, which was founded in 1906, also the oldest and largest school for the study of carillon and campanology in North America, the second oldest in the world. And so to receive that position was a very great honor.
That was fabulous. And of course, because you're such a brainiac, not only were you the carillonneur and on the organ faculty, but you taught physics, right?
Well,
of course, what else
happened
would
you do? So organically? Yeah. It was actually engineering. I created a course, which was the first course in the university's history, that was cross-listed with the art school, the music school, and the engineering school. And it was also designed for freshmen. So we basically introduced them to the bronze foundry in the art school. And in 15 weeks or so, we had them create and tune carillon bells. And then the very last week of the term, they had a recital, which very conveniently was at Christmas time. And I thought that would be a good lead into our first example here. You wanted to have some samples of my playing here, and so I mischievously chose some wonderful Christmas carols to start the show off with.
Yes, tell us about the carols and where you recorded that CD and everything else about it.
Well, that CD is called Fox Noel, and I'm especially pleased with how the logo on the CD turned out, because the Noel and the fox both commonly share an O, and it forms a cross, which is sort of a reminder of the origins of Christmas.
In a way, recorded at the Atlantic Fox Theater, right?
Yes, the Fabulous Fox in Atlanta, which is a 5,000 or so seat auditorium that houses a wonderful Mohler organ, which many people refer to as a theater organ. And what a theater organ is also a very long conversation.
We're going to have that in just a minute.
But it's a magnificent one-man orchestra, and contained therein behind the walls are all sorts of sounds, not just the instruments of the orchestra, but also the percussions, and in this case, a wonderful set of bells, very unique. And the album itself was almost an accident. The purpose for recording at the Atlanta Fox was to produce a different album, which we'll hear a cut from later, that was originally based around the theme of the building, which is Arabic. So the Christmas album was the second album we had recorded in that session. And the carols that I chose here in particular were the Alfred Burt carols, which are very special to me because I'm from Michigan. I'm a native of a very small farming community called Wright, Michigan, and Alfred Burt was a Michigan composer.
Wow. Oh, that's great. I didn't know that at all, and I've known his carols for a long, long time. We're going to hear all about that. Stay tuned to hear more from Dr. Stephen Ball, and this is Music from the Tower, and this is John Romeri. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, and we are having a great conversation with organist and carillonneur and everything else, Dr. Stephen Ball. Stephen, it's so great to have you here on the campus. You're no stranger to Christ Cathedral. You've been here and played carillon. You're the consultant for our carillon. Matter of fact, in a future show, you'll hear all about our own carillon and more about its restoration and things coming up for the carillon here. And as a carillon professor, you're the perfect choice for us. And we're so happy that you're helping us here at Christ Cathedral.
I'm happy to do that. And I think it's important to point out there is a relationship between the carillon and the organ, insofar as the one tends to be the external voice of the building, the other the internal voice. And so in many ways, the best way to describe my musical career is that of a public musician. And I think of myself oftentimes as a musician who happens to play the organ, who happens to play the carillon or other instruments. Each one is a manifestation of a musical idea.
You're such an entrepreneur for all of those things. I've known you in all of these roles. I first came to know you as the cathedral organist in Detroit, and I was privileged to do some choral festivals there, and Stephen was my accompanist. We still do a choral festival together each year in Rome for the Holy Father. At the Vatican, each Epiphany Christmas time, Stephen and I do a big choral festival with young children in Rome, and it's great. We've got our own Orange Diocesan Choir joining that festival this year. It's going to be great, and Steve is so wonderful to accompany that great festival. But beyond his cathedral musician days, we plucked him out of the University of Michigan and stole him from the Detroit Cathedral and dragged him east. And not only was he my assistant organist and artist-in-residence at the Philadelphia Cathedral, but the reason he came east was to be the organist at Boardwalk Hall, playing the largest instrument in the world. Well, when you got there, it wasn't the largest instrument in the world. It wasn't even a playing instrument, right? Tell us about that whole restoration project. Stephen has practically, single-handedly brought this instrument to the public view and back to life.
Well, it is the most incredible instrument ever created by human beings. It's installed in a very large facility. Boardwalk Hall is the former convention hall of Atlantic City. It was dedicated May 31st, 1929, and the structure covers about 7 acres on the site.
Inside the structure?
Yes. Just the span of the building's roof is about 7 acres.
How many was its original seating?
42,000.
Imagine, 42,000 in one space and this giant organ to go with it.
Yeah, well, the organ was simply on scale with the rest of the facility. And as with most entertainment venues at that time, the organ was completely invisible to the audience. So all 150 tons of this immense machine are concealed behind the walls. And the only thing visible to the general public would have been the organ console, where the organist sits and commands this very large machine.
And how many keyboards?
7 keyboards, 1,235 stops. And the instrument hasn't been fully functional since 1944. That was the year the Great Atlantic Hurricane hit the island. So for many, many reasons, the instrument slowly fell into disuse. Certainly by the 1970s, the instrument became silent. It hadn't been publicly presented in any way when I arrived in 2013 for 40 years or better.
When so, Hurricane Stephen Ball hit the island.
Yes, Hurricane Ball. But when I first arrived, on my first day of work, I'm not exaggerating, there were people in the building staff, who weren't even aware that there was an organ in the building.
Imagine that. You know, an iconic organ that every organist in the world knew, even though it didn't play, it had the most pipes all sitting there, silent. And just down the road in Philadelphia, of course, is the Wanamaker organ, which we all know and love. And that was the largest playing organ in the world, both organs within just a 30-minute drive of each other. And here's this one silent. So along comes Hurricane Ball, and now it's playing, right?
Well, the difference between Philadelphia and Atlantic City is that Philadelphia had been playing twice a day, every day except Sunday, since 1911. Atlantic City, because it fell silent, there was no cultural memory of the thing. And so the key to raising the $16 million necessary to return it, to fully operational is first it had to make sound, because the things it can say with its voice are far more eloquent than anything I could say with mine.
Hearing is believing with that instrument. So powerful, so huge.
Exactly. We're about 30% operational there now, and by the end of this year, we're expecting to be over 50% functional for the first time in over a half century. You can learn more about that organ project by visiting the website boardwalkorgans.org, or also the Facebook page, which is Pipe Organs of Boardwalk Hall, Atlantic City.
So now you play a concert every single day, right?
Yes, the routine throughout the summer, so our high season is May through October, is we do a free noon recital Monday through Friday, and that's followed by a free half-hour tour. During the off-season, so the fall and the winter, there's always a concert at 12 noon on Wednesdays, so the half-hour concert. And there's also, throughout the year, a very special two-hour-long tour that actually goes through parts of the organ and visits parts of the building that are normally closed. We call that the behind-the-scenes tour, and that starts every Wednesday at 10 a.m. In our very first year of operations in 2013, and as we started this concert series again, essentially, we saw over 10,000 visitors, and the numbers just keep growing and growing. They come from all over the world.
Well, it's certainly an organ like Hazel that's known everywhere. It's about bringing the world back to the consciousness of this gigantic machine.
Well, right. These instruments are all iconic, and the difference really is that many of the other iconic instruments we speak of, the Wanamaker organ, or here, of course, the cathedral organ, they're all visual instruments. Our instrument, the only thing that's visible to the public is the keyboard. And I think what makes the Boardwalk Hall so very important is that the organ that's contained there has technology that's unique in the 3,000-year history of organ building, things that had never been created before. And for that reason, it's a window into the future of how the thing will be built and how it'll be played, because there is musical potential there that doesn't exist anywhere else.
And some of those pipes are 64 feet tall, right?
Yes, the largest organ pipes in the world are there. There are only two organs that have a 64-foot stop. Boardwalk Hall has one of them. The other's in Sydney, Australia.
I played that organ as well. And I've been fortunate enough, privileged enough, to play some of the noon recitals for Steve when he's away on the road doing his own concerts somewhere else. And it's a real treat to play such a huge instrument. But there's a lot of mechanical things that don't work yet, right?
Oh, yes. It's
like the pistons. You have to do it all by hand with all those millions of stop dabs.
It's exceptionally difficult to program music that will engage every part of the audience, if possible. That's the goal. We try to find something everybody knows and then bring them something perhaps they've never heard, but they'll enjoy. And that's the joy and the enormous challenge of being a civic organist. Yeah. Which is essentially what the position is. In the 1920s, we had many, many municipal organists, many more municipal organs, and there were thousands of organs in American theaters playing accompaniments to films and to stage shows. So the number of positions has dwindled because the instruments themselves are fewer. The theater spent the same amount of money on an organ that we would spend in our time on a THX system. And that's very much how they were seen. They were understood as surround sound systems for their day. And they have a vast tonal palette. So church organs in some ways have a very specific set of colors and stops used for the liturgy. The theater organs are designed to be very far-reaching in their sonic
effects.
What
you're gingerly trying to say is we don't have any of the cool stuff, like whistles and car horns and train sounds and bird calls. We just have that churchy stuff, right? And you've got all the cool stuff, and you're not sharing it.
Well, it is a way to approach music. You know, of course, popular music has changed a lot in 100 years, but these organs are just palettes of color. That's how you can think of a pipe organ. It's the palette of color that an artist paints the painting with. And so the color choice is broader and more exceptional. It's the difference between pastels and neon. You know, sometimes neon wouldn't be the right color for the liturgy.
Well, but all those colors are great colors to have. And I think sometimes people say, oh, you have 20,000 pipes. It just must be deafeningly loud. Well, maybe if you turn them all on, but that also means you've got 20,000 colors, and you know, you've just got all this color. I can't wait to play a liturgy on Hazel when you can make that expression. And you touched just briefly on it being also spatial, you know, that it was the original surround sound, wasn't it? In churches, front organ, back organ. But let's hear one more little piece, and then we're going to talk a lot more about civic organs. Tell us what we're going to hear now. A little cut from your 1001 Nights, also at the Atlantic Fox.
This is a transcription of Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, which is a very large orchestral suite that lasts about 45 minutes long in four movements. And it's the first movement, The Sea and Sinbad's Ships. And to my knowledge, this is the first time anyone had transcribed the suite for organ.
And is this your own transcription?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
And what you're hearing is the organ's ability to mimic literally anything. It is a library of all sound. And in this case, the organist's goal is to create the illusion of listening to a symphony orchestra.
All right, well, we're going to hear that symphony orchestra. This is Steve Ball playing a little bit of Scheherazade for us. We'll be right back. This is Music from the Tower. We've got lots more to tell you. Dr. Stephen Ball on Music from the Tower. We've been talking about civic organs, the largest organ in the world. We're just kind of wrapping up a segment previously before this little break about the Boardwalk Hall organ, where Stephen Ball is the organist and just makes great music there every single day, Stephen.
Yes, it's a unique place and a unique history. The instrument is, as I mentioned, it hasn't been fully functional since 1944, and so we're in the process of trying to raise $16 million to return the thing to fully functional. And because of the unusual nature the unusual history of the place. I'm only the third staff organist in the building's history.
And how many years is that history?
The building was dedicated in 1929.
Wow.
And the organ, after the building was dedicated in May of 29, the organ project began in August of that year and was officially completed on December 5th, 1932. So it took an immense amount of time for Midmer Losh of Merrick, Long Island, to build the machine.
And much of that organ was built in the hall because it was too large to build elsewhere and bring in?
Well, built both in the hall, the large specialty things were built in the hall, and also in the factory in Merrick, Long Island. There we had a crew of about 65 guys working very long hours, 5-6 days a week, to build this machine in place. And part of what makes the technology so unique and important, and in some cases has examples of the technology we don't even fully understand, is the fact that not only was the space entirely unique and the availability of materials possible only at that time in history, but the organ project really began just before the Depression hit. The stock crash happened late in 29, and the project was funded by the city throughout the Depression.
Wow.
So there was a one-time availability of builders who wouldn't normally have continued their work with other companies because most other organ builders had to slow down or close their operations entirely.
And this continued on.
Yes.
As a civic project, I mean, isn't that amazing that a musical instrument, and remember, folks out there in radio land, organs are not economical instruments. It's not like a trumpet that plays a three octaves worth of notes or a flute on one little pipe. These are every single note of the organ is a pipe. Even if it's 60 feet tall, it only plays one note.
And I think that's one of the things that is so important to emphasize about the vast difference between the pipe organ and the electronic organ. And this is true of all acoustic sound versus amplified sound. I explain it to our visitors as the difference between plastic flowers and real flowers. The experience of acoustic sound, the range of dynamics and the power of the music, the power of the emotion which it can generate, can only be experienced in that place. You have to go to Boardwalk Hall in order to have that musical experience. You can't capture it in a recording. It's the largest range of frequencies produced by any musical instrument on Earth. The same is going to be true for Hazel. A recording is really just the creation of an illusion in our minds of
being in that space.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's, at the end of every broadcast, our regular listeners know, I encourage people every single show to go out and listen to live performance because there's nothing like it. And we're kind of in an age where, well, I hear music in my car. Well, I hear it on my iPod. You know, I hear music all the time. It's not like being in the space. There's nothing like hearing a 200 voice choir and an orchestra sing in the Arboretum or going to sing in Christ Cathedral. There's nothing like hearing Stephen Ball play 100,000 pipes all at once in a giant space that's 7 acres. You can't recapture that no matter how snazzy your Bose is, you know, your earphones or your system. So you've now play every day the largest organ in the world, but you're out here in Southern California because last night and the day before, two concerts, you played on the world's largest outdoor organ. What on earth was that like? You were at Balboa Park playing the Spreckles organ in San Diego. So tell us about that, a little bit of that experience.
I believe that the Spreckles organ in San Diego is the most fantastic and incredible venue for experiencing the pipe organ in the world. It is an immense instrument, over 5,000 pipes, installed in a building which was constructed in 1915 as part of the Panama, California Exposition, and a gift of John D. Spreckles to the city of San Diego and its citizens and the exhibition for their edification, not only give beauty to the place and the city, but also to be a central attraction to that world's fair that was happening there.
Just a place to have a good time.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, these are free concerts. Every concert's free, even though, you know, they're bringing world-class artists like Stephen to town. These are somehow funded by donors and patrons and the city itself, right?
Yes, the city has been deeply supportive of the project as well as the Spreckles Organ Foundation, and they have sponsored concerts at the pavilion, not only the weekly Sunday concerts, which happen there at 2 p.m.
Every Sunday. At 2 o'clock.
and completely free of charge. That was the stipulation of Mr. Spreckle's gift, was that none of the programming should charge admission. But also they have a very special concert series on Monday evenings in the summer, and those concerts begin at 7:30, and I was very privileged to be their guest yesterday.
Well, last night I was in attendance, and we heard Stephen play everything from a classic march to a medley of Sound of Music to accompanying an entire film. Tell us what that's like. That's a whole nother art under your fingers that none of us, no matter how long we played the organ, possess.
Well, the film, understanding film is, if I do my job correctly, you won't even know I'm there. And what I was doing was, of course, providing a musical accompaniment to a silent film. We sort of forget that we've been watching film for a very long time. You know, film is 125 or more years old. So the first 40 years of that technology, we didn't have the ability to embed a soundtrack with a picture. And we call those silent films, but that's a misnomer because the films were never silent. They always had music accompanying them.
And almost always the organ, yes.
Very frequently the organ. The organs were wonderful ways to fill the larger theaters with sound. As the first storefront theaters, which were very small, little Nickelodeons, expanded, and as the number of seats expanded, the need to have greater sound volume from the musicians increased, and people forget that the theaters opened oftentimes around midday, around noon, and didn't close until midnight. So if you had your theater orchestra trying to play for 12 hours a day, every day, you'd kill them. So the organ was a very practical way to make an
entertaining
experience.
Well, and we know
experience.
The major houses, like Radio City, there are two giant pipe organs that pop out and play before every show, and then the organists slide into the wall, and away they go. But what a way to, and of course, that's why you got all the cool stuff on those organs. Last night in the film, constantly you're saying, wait a minute, I'm seeing that church bell play, I'm hearing it ring, but I had to keep reminding myself that that film is silent. And that was you over there at the organ making the tower bell ring and the train roll by and the car horn every time and a little knock of somebody's leg as you kick someone. All of those sounds emanated from your fingers and your score over at the organ.
Yes, and in addition to all of those sound effects, so that's the foley of the film, you also have to weave musical ideas. And so every character has a theme associated with them, and you create a large sense of continuity in the picture because you're always associating thematic material with characters. And
yes, it's like a little leitmotif. You know, a character would come in the room and we'd hear that character's theme. Then the other character would enter, and now we've got two themes going. And Mr. Happy Fingers over there is just entreating us with all of these great things. So these civic organs became places where we heard classical repertoire. We heard transcriptions of symphonic repertoire because not every town had a symphony, not like today where the San Francisco Orchestra goes on tour. Orchestras didn't do that, but maybe in your town you heard a transcription of a symphony on a big symphonic organ.
Yes, and these were very much ways that people experienced entertainment together. The entertainment culture of the 21st century is very different than what was the entertainment culture of the 20th century. It's corporate entertainment was much more common. Now our entertainment's being commoditized. You know, we hear things in our iPhones. We have little speakers projecting music from everywhere. So last night's program, the last thing we all did as a community experience, as an audience, was everybody started singing quite spontaneously, God Bless America. For me, that was maybe the high point of the whole evening.
Well, and there was about 4,000 people in attendance. The park was packed to the gills of all these people, and you came back out for an encore, and it happened to be God Bless America, and everybody just busted into song, and it was amazing how everybody stood up. You know, they didn't stay seated. They stood up. They were all excited from the film and from the concert. What a way to experience a totally free concert like that with the organ. So let's hear a transcription. This is The Sunken Cathedral by Debussy, all transcribed to the organ. Is this your transcription as well?
Yes, and this is a good example of how the organ can impart to what would have originally been, it's a very beautiful tone poem for the piano by Debussy, The Legend of the Cathedral of Ys, off the coast of France, which sunk below the waves centuries ago, and on very still days when there's no wind, fishermen in their boats overhead can can still hear the chanting of the monks and the tolling of the bells.
Well, and this is Stephen Ball playing on his No Place Like Oz album, The Sunken Cathedral by Debussy. We'll be back in the next segment to talk about the future of the organ. Stay tuned. Back. This is Music from the Tower. I'm your host, John Romeri, and today we've been enjoying Stephen Ball, organist par excellence for sure, classical organist, doctorate of organ, theater organist, silent film accompanist, plays the largest organ in the world, was out here playing the largest outdoor organ in the world, certainly will be here at Christ Cathedral in a very near future to play the fifth largest organ in the world. So do you just go around playing only large organs, or what is this, Stephen?
Well, I think the one can tell just as much or more about a builder from their small instruments. My greatest interest in studying every instrument I can possibly encounter is to know where we're headed. And in many ways, honestly, I'm very concerned about the future of the organ. I'm even worried about it. And I think some of my colleagues are very surprised to hear me when I say this. When I was at the University of Michigan, I was also the director of a major musical instrument museum called the Stearns Collection of Musical Instruments, which is still one of the largest in the world.
Just one more of your little sidelights that you...
Well, I'm bringing that up for a reason, which is that in a musical instrument museum, the way that instruments evolve, the study of that path is called organology. It has nothing to do with the organ itself, but organology is the discipline of studying the evolution of musical instruments. And at that time, I realized that all instruments evolve in predictable paths. The volume, the dynamic range of the instrument and the compass increase. You find other characteristics of the instruments always continuing to change. And the change itself is indicative of the fact that society is interested enough in the instrument to continue investing in it. In other words, there has to be a sort of motor in society generating interest in an instrument for it to continue evolving and for people to continue being engaged by it musically.
And trained to play it.
Exactly, because the instruments themselves are both tremendously expensive to build and tremendously expensive to train musicians for, in a way.
Constantly we hear from the American Guild of Organists about the organist shortage. It's one thing to have great pipe organs. It's another thing to have really trained organists. Many times people say, oh, I don't like the organ at all, but they've never really heard an organist play it. They've only heard a pianist who's been recruited, and they don't use the pedals. They don't know how to use the stops. So, has the heyday of the organ passed?
The key to saving the organ is having important instruments in public places. And I think that the danger of the organ, since it is such an ancient instrument, is that organists tend to rest on their laurels and look too much to the past rather than to the future. The earliest pieces we have preserved in the organ literature that I'm aware of currently predate Columbus's arrival by about 100 years.
Wow.
But we know the organ is much more ancient. The organ goes back to the ancient Greeks. And even for the first 2,000 years of its existence, it wasn't even being used in the church. Now we only associate the organ with church in our society.
That's an interesting observation, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when the Western Roman Empire fell, knowledge of organ building was preserved in Byzantium. It's actually thanks to the Assyrians that the knowledge of organ building was transmitted through the Near East to Byzantium, and then from Byzantium back to the Western Roman Empire, in the 9th and 10th centuries. So only then, at that point, do we see its reintroduction to Western Europe and the organ starting to become a part of the liturgy again.
Well, it's an interesting history, isn't it? Because when you think of the early church, there was no organ. It was just singing, you
yes.
know, a Gregorian chant unaccompanied. And then the organ found its way into the liturgy. And now I have brides say, well, I just want the piano. The organ sounds too churchy.
And the organ found its way into the liturgy because it provided a solemnity and a splendor which was absolutely unique. It was a type of musical experience which nothing else could provide, and in many ways the most profound sonic experience that could be had in its time. Now, we walk out our front doors and we're assaulted with, you know, diesel trucks rumbling by. Those have the same frequencies you'd hear in an organ, and jet planes passing overhead. So the organ is competing not only with the increasing noise level of our society, but also with amplified sound. And one of the characteristics of amplified sound and acoustic sound is that amplified sound, it's sort of like oil and water. The two don't mix well. And organs require a very resonant acoustic. They like the same things that symphony orchestras like in terms of their acoustical environment. That, in our day and age, is something that is not so often understood.
Yes, churches get drier and drier, less acoustic, because we're using microphones, and, you know, we're going to blast it all through that.
And all of the music of the church, since ancient times, and even the documents that speak of church music, speak of Gregorian chant as the paradigm. And you know, there's always this wonderful image of St. Gregory being dictated to by the Holy Spirit. If you find some stained glass windows, I frequently see this in, you have the Holy Spirit sitting on Gregory's shoulder in the form of a dove, dictating the melodies of the chants. And those chants, in their way, remain perpetually relevant to us. Yet we have to remember the they came from a musical environment. They themselves have a setting, just as the organ does. The organ is a venue-dependent instrument.
Well, and we talked earlier with Paul Jacobs in a previous show about, you know, the use of churches now that don't even have a space for the organ. They have a space for their rock band. Their acoustic instruments just aren't present. There isn't even a real piano, leave alone a real organ, in a building like that. Yet, on the other hand, how hopeful it is to see great organs like Hazel being restored and brought to their prominence. How wonderful it is to have Disney Hall and Segerstrom Hall here in the Southern California, but really concert halls everywhere, Philadelphia, Chicago, Dallas. You know, these great instruments being put back into symphony halls, civics places, you know.
Well, these are people who have discovered, and symphony audiences increasingly so, that there is a kinetic experience involved in hearing a pipe organ. You do not have the same physical interaction with sound if it's just simply amplified.
Amplified sound. Well, I was the organist for St. Louis Symphony for 14 years, and I played an electronic, and half the time my wife Karen would say, well, I saw you moving, but I never heard anything, you know? And now I'm hearing those same things in when I was living in Philadelphia with that great Kimmel Center organ, but you could feel those low pedals. You could feel all that stuff. It just wasn't loud noise, but it was actually something moving my body hearing
it's
this
profound.
Great sound.
I think that these instruments, and certainly the magic of the organ, is that it has the power to move hearts and minds as nothing else does.
Well, in liturgy, in the public, through a film, through a theater sound, through theater instruments, and you, my friend, Stephen Ball, play all of that. You know, you are a party like no other organist I know to every little aspect of that piece. You're such a champion for the organ, and we're glad that you're part of our team and consultants here at Christ Cathedral. We're glad to have had you here in Southern California. We hope you make many, many more visits. I know you'll be playing Hazel as soon as it's in, and it's just been great to have you with us here at Music from the Tower, because you bring a whole perspective to the organ that even most organists don't have. They don't share that vision of all the aspects. The civic, normal church organist would never think of the ramifications of a civic organ and what that means to the public. We have the last cut I'd like to have you introduce is from an album that you made at the Detroit Cathedral back when you were the organist there. Tell us a little bit about this piece.
Yes, this shows you a bit of the classical training, of course, that you have to survive a doctorate in organ. And this is music of René Becker, who was the first music director of the cathedral. I became intensely interested in Becker's work and found some of his relatives, his son, in fact, were still very involved in the Archdiocese of Detroit, and became aware after knowing the family that the entire group of compositions that Becker had done, hundreds of compositions, were all still owned by the family, and they were seeking an appropriate place to bring them so that they could be preserved in perpetuity.
Well, certainly your recording of these organ works are amazing, and I'm sure this album has done very well, and it's recorded on the actual cathedral organ which he played.
Yes, these are all compositions which were known to be associated in some way with this instrument. This instrument, it's a wonderful Cassavant organ installed in 1925, is how Becker thought of composition in many ways. This is the original compositions being played on the original instrument.
So it's like the instrument shaping his compositional style and his composition shaping probably the way instruments were created in that day.
Very much. And I'm very happy to say that as a result of my being at the cathedral and at the university at that time, I was able to arrange for the gift of all of Becker's compositions to the University of Michigan Music Library.
Oh,
their
that's
special
wonderful.
Collections, which is where they're housed today, if anyone wants to study them. And I would say that at that time, it was considered to be one of the most, if not the most significant gift of original manuscript compositions that had ever been given the music library.
Well, another way that you're helping preserve the legacy of the organ. Stephen Ball, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on Music from the Tower. Just hearing all the facets of the work that you do is amazing. And so now we're going to hear this wonderful piece by Becker, the Music Gothique. And this is John Romeri. Thank you again for being with us at Music from the Tower. We hope that before the next show, you will go out and enjoy a live performance of some great music in live performance. Maybe even catch a performance by Stephen Ballett someday. Thank you for listening. See you next time.